Good morning. Hello and welcome again to Denton's Perspective. This is a daily briefing we're giving from the Republican and Democratic conventions, which we're offering to our friends around the globe. Each morning, we're gathering to discuss the stories and policies behind the headlines each day with those who shape them and understand them best. I'm Kathleen O'Connor. I'm a member of the Denton's Public Policy and Regulation Practice, and I'll be the moderator for today's program. Today, we'll be joined by former Bush White House political director, Ron Kaufman. Ron is a member of the Republican National Committee as a national committee man from Massachusetts and served as the co-chair of the Convention Rules Committee. We think where Ron sits, he has an unparalleled view of the palace intrigue from the last week. We're also joined by former Vermont governor and presidential candidate Howard Dean, and thank you, Governor, for joining us again today to represent the other side of the aisle. Both men are members of our Denton's public policy team. This program series, from the moderated discussion to the policy open mic with former U.S. Ambassador to Canada, Gordon Giffin, another member of the Denton's public policy team, may be considered as on the record. A recording of this will be available midday on our website, www.dentons.com, http://dentons.com. Everyone listening can find out more about the topics we discussed today by following us on Twitter at @Dentons. So now that I've got all the housekeeping out of the way, let's get to the real reason we're all here, which is really politics. I would be remiss if I did not first ask Governor Howard Dean to discuss the events of last night. I have to ask you, Governor, as a former presidential candidate, what would you have done if what happened last night to Melania Trump had happened to your wife? What do you think the consequences of last night are to this convention and to the campaign going forward?
Here's the problem with this. First of all, the loyal Trump people are not going to be fazed. I assume you're talking about the fact that she basically borrowed a paragraph out of Michelle Obama's 2008 speech. That was just sloppiness on the Trump campaign. They didn't have to do that. They should have known better. They should have known it was going to be on the internet, that somebody was going to discover this. And there's a fairly devastating video out juxtaposing Michelle Obama giving her version of that paragraph and Melania Trump. Having said that, I don't think it affects Trump's numbers very much. The loyal Trump people are going to like Trump no matter what, because Trump has said far worse things during the campaign. So all this is a battle for the 10% of Americans that are going to decide this election. And so it reinforces the Democrats' claim that Trump is dishonest and so forth and so on. And this stuff isn't going to bother the loyal Trump people at all. But what I would have done, of course, is fired the person who wrote that speech, and hopefully had somebody who read it ahead of time to figure this out.
Well, I appreciate that. Ron, I'm wondering, from where you're sitting out there in Cleveland, is there any outcry for a change in leadership at the top of this campaign? I haven't heard anything yet this morning talking about any heads rolling or consequences from the fallout last night. Do you have anything to add to that, Ron?
Well, good morning, Kathleen. First of all, I hate to say there's a lot to do about nothing, but it is. We had the largest audience, we believe, ever on a first Monday of a convention. And Mrs. Trump's numbers went through the roof. She delivered a powerful, eloquent, and forceful speech that was well received by the audience, particularly people who were not just Trump supporters, but were undecided. And I have no idea how those words made it into her speech. But the bottom line is, it's not about that, it's about Mrs. Trump. And people watching it were comparing her to Jackie Kennedy. She's a bright, articulate person who I think anyone who watched last night could very well see her being First Lady of the country. That's what matters.
So no call for change in leadership or anything that you're hearing this morning.
There may be, when it all unravels and we figure out what happened, I'm sure there may be a speechwriter looking for a job someplace. But the bottom line, it's not going to change what was a terrific night for Donald Trump and the Trump campaign last night. You have to remember, in this country, 3 months ago, most people were believing that the Republican convention would be chaos, that we would not have a nominee presumptive, and we'd have three people battling to the end. And that's not the case. Sure, we had some folks who are not as happy as they could have been if their person had won, but it's minor. They couldn't even get enough votes to ask for a roll call vote. So I'm very comfortable that we had a terrific first night. I know the Trump campaign's happy with it, and I know that Donald Trump is happy with it, save the controversy over Mrs. Trump's speech.
Well, thanks for that, Ron. You know, I'd be interested to know your thoughts, too, just because you're not only a delegate, but you're also a national committee man, and I'm curious to know if you really believe that establishment Republicans are genuinely coalescing around Donald Trump as the nominee, or is this more an environment that's likened to an uncomfortable detente, wherein the D.C. crowd is simply swallowing Trump because he isn't Hillary Clinton? Any thoughts on that, Ron?
Oh, sure. In this country, this political season, it is different. It's very different. Both parties were affected by populism, which changed the direction of the campaign. Excuse me. And it is very much anti-establishment in both parties. And therefore, this convention is going to reflect that. We have more first-time goers to the convention at any time in modern political history in this country. And it's a different campaign. The message is different. That's why Donald Trump became the nominee. And it's not surprising that we don't have as many elected officials speaking, because quite frankly, we don't want to. So I like our first day. It was Make America Safe Again. And if you watched the whole day, the people who spoke, it was a very, very powerful day, ending with Mrs. Trump and Rudy Giuliani, who brought the house down. So I'll take three more days like this, and we'll be ahead next week.
Well, let's just stay for 1 second on the kind of what I would characterize as the establishment discontent, with the primary being especially bruising, you know, with Donald Trump kind of eviscerating the field of some of the Republican Party's biggest and brightest voices, you know, Low Energy Jeb, Lion Ted, Little Marco, and with the lack of the presence of either President George H.W. Bush or George W. Bush, and the lack of presence of Mitt Romney and John McCain, the two last nominees. I mean, is there a palpable disconnect out there between the party establishment and supporters of the nominee? And do you consider that at all a liability moving into the general election?
Well, listen, we're coming together faster than we thought we were going to do, in my opinion. We have 16 men and women who didn't win, and they're not always as happy as they could be. But there's more people voted Republican than ever before in history. More people voted for Donald Trump than any man in the Republican Party in history. 100 million more people watched the Republican debates than Democrat debates. And I think that this convention and this election is going to be viewed in a different light. And it's not just here. It's around the world. We're seeing a more populist movement pretty much in every country. So I think it's no different. I think it's a very unsettled world, and people are worried, scared, and frightened about the future. And Donald Trump's message and the message of this convention, in my opinion, is going to reflect that.
Helpful insight. Governor Dean, I'd ask you the same question, having yourself gone through a tough primary battle as a presidential candidate. How do you heal those wounds, and do you see this convention or an opportunity during the general election for candidate Donald Trump to do that?
I don't think he can. I mean, obviously, I totally disagree with Ron's assessment. I think Giuliani was a disaster for the – he was great inside the hall, but he basically toyed with racism. And I think people forget in the United States sometimes, especially from those from other countries, that we have an enormous minority population, Donald Trump has systematically, obviously unintentionally, but, well, no, probably intentionally, driven away black and Hispanic voters. He was at 14% in the Hispanic community in their most recent poll. You've got to get around 35% if you're a Republican to win the presidency. This is the lowest number I've ever seen among in a Republican for a Republican candidate in the Hispanic community. That is not, so, you know, Rudy can get up there and rant and rave and carry on, but every time he does that, people who are not in the hall are going, gee, you know, isn't this just more divisive? So, you know, first of all, I don't think Donald Trump can heal the Republican Party. I mean, when you have the last former presidents, including George H.W. Bush, who was widely respected by a lot of moderate, reasonable, thoughtful Americans on both sides, refusing to go to the convention, there's a very strong signal sent. I don't think Donald Trump can expand beyond his base, of his core base of angry, populist, white, older men, and some women. But he doesn't really – I mean, I know they put a few people of color and a few young people out front, which happens every year. But I go – I was in the hall of the Republican convention in 2008, and I tell you, it's just a – it's a party that doesn't look anything like the United States of America demographically. And in 2012, every minority group in America, except for Vietnamese Americans, including Cuban Americans, by the way, voted for a Democrat. That is going to be even more accentuated, and the minority number of minority voters has only grown from 2012 to this year. So, again, this is great theater for the loyalists and the people who are really angry and want to change. It's not great theater for people who are worried about how to cope with the problems of America in a mature way. And I think that is – I think this convention is a problem for Donald Trump. I think it's great for his base, and I think it's not so great for people who are trying to decide who they're going to vote for.
Kathleen, if I could amend what the governor said a tad bit. First of all, George W. Bush, 43, as we call him here, didn't go to the last two conventions since he left office. And George Herbert Walker Bush, likewise, was not planning to attend this convention, even if his son was the nominee. So that's not really a big surprise to anyone. But believe me, I think both parties have got this populist vote in their system right now. The good news for us, Donald Trump is more of a centrist. And our friend Bernie Sanders has pulled his party and his nominee far to the left. And in the end, this election is a little different. I think there's two distinct forces at work here. One, as the governor so accurately said, is demographics. And our party, our country is demographically changing drastically. And that's going to be an issue in this campaign and something that Republicans have to do better with, clearly. But the other force at work here is mood of the country. And I think sometimes people forget how important mood is when it comes to election day. And right now, the mood in this country is as bad as it's been in my lifetime. And unfortunately, that's a long time. And I'm convinced that that mood will be very beneficial for Donald Trump and not so good for Hillary Clinton if she should be the nominee in Philadelphia.
Interesting perspective. Thank you, Ron. And I was unaware of the role of the Bush family during the previous convention, so that's helpful to understand better. I'd ask you, Governor Dean, and just speaking about mood and talking about the impact that will have on Election Day. We listened yesterday at the convention to many speakers, including U.S. Senator Tom Cotton, who's a combat veteran of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he really tore into Hillary Clinton as unfit to command the military and protect America in this dangerous world. With the increasing frequency of the lone wolf's attack, like those that we saw last week in Nice and Orlando the month before, do you expect this election will be defined by national security? I recall yesterday you saying, you referencing this in our conversation, talking about how unless it's wartime, you know, it doesn't drive votes. but I'm curious to know and to hear your thoughts on yesterday's kind of conversation out at the convention and whether or not you expect that national security will be kind of a defining theme.
I'm not sure it'll be a defining theme, but national security will be an important theme. And so, you know, I expect more discussions about this. And the, again, the question will be, how do you respond? Do you respond in a thoughtful, measured, experienced way, or do you just say, you know, we're going to keep everybody out of the country, we're going to kick them all out, we're going to build a wall? At some point, thoughtful people are going to say, you know, I used to be a Republican, but I can't do this. And I think there's a, I think there are more people who are going to think like that than there are who are going to say, you know, build the wall and keep all the Muslims out and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there is there's definitely going to be a huge emotional desire to vote that way, and I think a lot of people will. And could Donald Trump win? Yes, he could. But this is the kind of thing that led to the vote for Brexit in Europe, and we talked about this yesterday. There are a lot of people who have been left behind by globalization all over the world, not just in Western democracies. And we have to deal with that, and the business community has to deal with that. And it's not just our responsibility, it's our requirement for survival as a civilized society. And that's a huge issue. So the question is, how do we respond now that we're here? I personally believe, as Ron will have no surprise about, that Hillary Clinton is far better equipped, certainly than Tom Cotton, who has sort of been way out there on defense issues and his rhetoric, and absolutely more than Donald Trump, to deal with security issues. She's done this for 4 years. She understands the turf. She knows that you have to be measured in foreign policy. And I think that's actually the biggest issue, and it's why I chose to support Hillary very, very early, is, you know, the country will survive a Donald Trump economically. We're a very strong, diverse country. Economic policy is not made by the president. It's really made by the chairman of the Federal Reserve and by 50 million business people who make decisions every year. So, but what I do worry deeply about is Trump's willingness to change his position day by day and be incredibly careless with words. Words matter a lot in foreign policy, and misunderstandings are what really causes most of the trouble, and it can be very, very serious trouble. So, will national security be an issue? I think it will. I think the Republicans will try to crank it up as much as possible. At the end of the day, I think we probably win that argument. But I do agree with Ron that that it is an argument that I think the Republicans will exploit, and I think they could be successful unless we have some good counter arguments.
Well, thank you, Governor. And Ron, you know, it kind of begs the question on Trump's inexperience on national security. You've got, and as Governor Dean just referenced his own words, you've got, you know, the Republican candidate saying he listens to shows for advice on foreign policy. How does the campaign and how does the Republican Party handle that lack of experience on national security as it moves through the campaign? And he's running against a former Secretary of State.
I think in this climate, in this mood, as I mentioned earlier, her experience, quote-unquote, is going to be a big net negative. Every single poll you see in this country, when it talks about, is America more respected today than it was 8 years ago, the answer is no. Are we more safe than we were 4 years ago? The answer is no. And the truth is, when it comes to foreign policy, defense measures, security measures, she represents the third term of President Obama. And, you know, these kinds of elections following two-term presidents is really, in many reflects, many ways, the reflection of how people view this president. And just like there's a reason why George Herbert Walker Bush is the only president to become president from vice president in many, many years, and that's because people traditionally want change after 8 years. As a country, we're big on change, and this is going to be a change election. The mood reflects that. The polls reflect that. And I think our convention, in the end, will reflect that. And it's very hard. Once one candidate gets that change message, as the Democrats found out in 1980, it's hard to break it. And I believe strongly that this is going to be, as the governor said, a very close election. a different kind of election. I think Donald Trump will end up winning some states that my party hasn't won in a long time. And I think there'll be some states that maybe Mrs. Clinton, if she's a nominee, or Bernie Sanders, will get the, will win that state. So it's going to be a different election, but to me it seems clear that change is in the wind.
And Governor Dean, does she have to run away from the Obama foreign policy legacy?
Absolutely not. No, I don't think so. Obama's got much better personal ratings than either Trump or Hillary Clinton. And so I, you know, the people who hate Obama hate Obama. They've made a career of it for the last 8 years. But I don't think that's going to fundamentally change how the electorate votes. I think President Obama's an asset on the campaign trail. His numbers are in the 50s now, for the positive numbers, for the first time in a long time. And I don't think she's going to run away from him at all. And I think that's a good thing.
Interesting. Well, we'll move to the kind of some of the talk out there, Ron, has been related to the pick of Governor Pence as Donald Trump's running mate. For a candidate who's as unconventional as Donald Trump, his selection of a running mate was the first glimpse for voters and constituents as the sort of president he might be. What did that selection of Mike Pence, you know, say about Trump?
Well, historically, there are two kinds of vice president's nominees pick. One is a political pick who helps you win a state or two, gives you some, brings the party together, and that's one type of vice president pick. But the best VP pick is one who helps you govern. I think that Ronald Reagan back in 1980 was very wise in picking George Herbert Walker Bush, who was obviously one of the best men ever trained to be president, and gave Ronald Reagan, an outsider, the image of, I understand what it takes to govern, and I want someone who can help me govern. I think the same is true with his son, W, when he picked Dick Cheney. He, again, was not an insider, and Dick Cheney was. I think the reason that Obama picked Biden was that he gave him that same sense of helping to govern. And I think that Donald Trump realizes he is an outsider. He's run as an outsider. But if he's going to be able to govern, he needed a vice president that could help him govern. And Governor Pence is very well respected on both sides of the aisle, particularly in defense and foreign affairs. So it's a very, very good pick. He's also been a great governor of Indiana, and he is a very popular among the conservative wing of the Republican Party. So I think he was a terrific pick, and I think he'll get points, if you will, from being smart enough and understanding enough to know the kind of pick he needed to make versus what's a perfectly smart pick.
Well, we got Governor Dean's thoughts on the VP pick yesterday when he endorsed, you know, Newt Gingrich for vice president, and we appreciated that yesterday, so thank you, Governor. But, Ron, I wanted to note, I mean, do you think this Pence selection helps bring some of the establishment types back in because of his conservative credentials, or is that case already baked?
No, I think so. No, I think he is a uniting force. He is a very, again, thoughtful, respected man. We all love Speaker Gingrich. He's part of the firm, and would have been a terrific pick. And my guess is he'll be a very influential player, in the upcoming Trump administration. And that's good for all of us. I think he made the right pick for this time, for this mood of the country, and for him personally. So I'm happy about it. I think the delegates here are very happy about it. You could sense in conventions when things happen, the mood changes one way or the other. And the day he picked, announced Trump, Pence, you could sense the a lift and a step of most of the delegates at the convention.
Interesting. I appreciate that. And today the convention speakers are expected to focus on how to, in quotes, make America first again through economic policy. Mr. Trump's economic plank, though, is dramatically more populist than anything Republicans have run on in recent memory. So how do more mainstream Republicans, like former Trump rivals, whether it's Scott Walker or Marco Rubio, who are both also speaking tonight, how do they modulate Mr. Trump's brand of economic republicanism into their own view of government and the market? How does that work, Ron, do you think?
Well, I think the Donald Trump has outlined in broad terms the direction he wants to take this country economically. There is absolutely no question that our country is in worse shape today than it was 8 years ago, particularly if you happen to live in the inner city, particularly if you happen to be an African-American or Hispanic or in the middle class. And there's no question, I think people, a part of the mood in this country is people want to see a huge difference in the way our economy goes and grows. We've had very anemic economic growth, and it's really hurt the middle class in particular. And I think that when elected, Donald Trump will pick a very diverse group of economic advisors, like he did in his business world, and bring them together and have some huge changes in the direction, the shape, and the form of our economy. And I think it's going to be well received, and I think it's going to be a big factor in this election.
I have to strongly disagree. Ron and I are great friends. And we are, and we share a candy jar. At least he supplies the candy. eat it. But to say that we're much worse off than we were 11 years ago, I mean 8 years ago, when millions more people were out of work, when the stock market was in the tank, when the detritus of the Bush, well, let's not get partisan about this, when the detritus of the Wall Street collapse was affecting every American, to say that we're not better off 8 years ago is just fanciful, just ridiculous.
There's no, I hope that's the question that voters walk into the polling place with. And they just had one question in their brain. Are you better off today, to quote another great person, are you better off today economically than you were 4 years ago? This will be a huge victory for Donald Trump.
And
it does remain to be seen. I agree, Governor. But how do you think, Ron, the kind of the establishment, if you will, and I keep going back to that, but that's, you know, you've got Scott Walker and Marco Rubio tonight. Do you have any insight on what they're talking about in their view of Donald Trump's kind of economic message as they're trying to keep to the theme of making America first again?
Well, you know, Kathleen, my hero, as you know, and the governor knows, is George Herbert Walker Bush. And I remember when Governor Reagan picked him to be VP, every press person in the country, every headline was talking about the fact that George Herbert Walker Bush had talked about Governor Reagan's economic plan as voodoo economics. And this is going to be a death knell of a ticket in the party. It wasn't. We had 8 great years under Ronald Reagan. I think that we'll see how it all turns out. But folks are going to come together. Listen, there's 2 options, maybe 2.5. You can either vote for Hillary Clinton and or Bernie Sanders, or you can vote for Donald Trump. And when you have, for my party, there's no more unifying factor than those options. And I'm quite sure the governor would say the same thing about his party. So this is going to be a very interesting race to the wire. But again, I think the mood is clearly on the side of change and populism. And that speaks volumes for what Donald Trump's chances are. And I think the fact that Bernie Sanders and Senator Warren of Massachusetts has dragged the platform and Mrs. Clinton so far to the left, making this the most liberal ticket in the history of our elections is going to help Donald Trump even more.
Well, I'd have to step in here for a moment. Actually, most of the things that are in the platform are deeply supported by Americans. The $15 minimum wage may be considered to the left, but the vast majority of Americans support that. The vast majority of Americans, including most of the Donald Trump voters, believe that they've been screwed by the establishment financial system. Whether it's true or not, that's what they believe. So, you know, I think the day of screaming liberal at Democratic candidates and having that be a winning ploy is probably over.
Well, thank you. Thank you both, Governor Dean and Ron, for your thoughts today. It's 10 o'clock, and for those listening today, we'll be joined again tomorrow and Thursday by both Governor Dean and Ron Kaufman. But now I'm going to turn the mic over and introduce former United States Ambassador to Canada, Gordon Giffin, a friend and a partner in Denton's public policy practice and a preeminent expert on bilateral trade between the United States and our neighbor to the north. Ambassador Giffin, we're interested to hear your thoughts on the trajectory of the trade policy in the United States and whether you believe Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump have both, we obviously know they have diverging views, but what's the impact of those views? And also, you know, I'll be interested to hear how you think Trump's economic populism, you know, that the Republican Party as like an anti-free trade or some of your thoughts on that as well. I think our listeners would be interested in. So with that,
thank you,
Gordon.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. I have to say it's tough following Ron and Governor Dean because what they've had to say is probably a heck of a lot more interesting in the morning than the substance of trade policy. But I'll try and make a few comments as an overview. I think every 4 years when we have a presidential race in the United States, we find two candidates, particularly when they're non-incumbent candidates, who express skepticism about trade agreements. If you look back over the years, there's very few candidates for president who have been pro-trade agreements, but there have been very few presidents who have not been pro-trade agreements. So we tend to see a transition between candidate and incumbent on the question of trade agreements. If you recall in 2008, particularly as the primary campaign got into the Midwest, Ohio and Michigan, et cetera. Then candidate Senator Obama declared that he would renegotiate NAFTA. And that was a very strong arguing point that he made to try and distinguish himself from Hillary Clinton, whose husband, as we all know, ended up taking the NAFTA agreement that George Herbert Walker Bush negotiated and passing it through the Congress. At that time, Hillary Clinton was more defensive of NAFTA, but not strongly vocal in her support. So this year, it's not surprising to me that we have pending, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, much broader, much more significant in terms of its global reach as a trade agreement than NAFTA was. And that agreement was negotiated by the Barack Obama administration. The irony as compared to his campaign in 2008. So Mr. Trump does not say that he is anti-trade agreements. What he says is that he is anti-bad trade agreements. Typically, you never find someone who believes that any trade agreement was well negotiated if it wasn't their administration that did it. But I think as it relates to NAFTA, as it relates to TPP, certainly Mr. Trump's position is that he could have negotiated and would negotiate a much better agreement on behalf of American commercial and economic interests. So I think it's important to note that he isn't, quote, anti-trade agreements. He's just anti-anybody else's trade agreements, which is not novel. Secretary Clinton has expressed reservations about the TPP as written. Importantly, she has not said, I am against trade agreements. She has said, I would do a better job of negotiating this particular trade agreement. So I think the language that people are using is important. My instinct is that either of these two candidates, once president, would be much more interested in trade agreements because the fact is most other countries have access to our market. Their goods and services come in to the United States with few, there are some, but few limitations today. Trade agreements for the United States are all about gaining access for our goods and services into other more restricted markets. And typically when someone gets into office, they realize that, and the opportunity to assist our industries and professions to access markets become the priority of that new government. Now, importantly, many of our trading partners around the world, and certainly Canada right next door, have said, fine, if the United States wants to withdraw from multilateral trade negotiations like the TPP, that's fine. We would prefer that we have these multilateral agreements, but we'll just go ahead and do a series of bilateral trade agreements so our companies and our professional services providers will actually have a leg up on Americans, because we'll do a bilateral deal with the countries that the United States won't have a trade agreement with. So our friends are happy to compete with us in a world where we're hamstrung and they're not. The discussion about NAFTA has become sort of a representative term of trade agreements. We hear negative comments about NAFTA today again in the campaign. I think while there are segments of our country that have been dislocated in some measure because of an NAFTA agreement, by any fair measure overall, the United States has benefited economically from NAFTA. And importantly, our neighbor to the south, Mexico, has benefited also from NAFTA. These are not supposed to be zero-sum deals. The idea is to improve the economies of all participants, and it's awfully important to our economic interests as a country, but also our security interests as a country, that our neighbors be prosperous. And the more prosperous Mexico's economy has become, the less Mexican citizens or residents of Mexico are inclined to want to leave Mexico and come to the United States in search of employment. So part of the success of NAFTA has actually been the growth of the Mexican economy as well as ours. By definition, the two economies have benefited from NAFTA, as has Canada. I think, important to note that Canada is on the verge of signing their trade agreement that they've negotiated with the European Union. That will likely take place in October. The United States is negotiating a trade agreement with the European Union, but we have certainly not concluded that. Mexico already has one, so if we're the sort of the mayonnaise in the sandwich, where Canada has a trade agreement with the European Union, Mexico has one, but the United States does not, the opportunities for American businesses will be restricted, and for investment in the United States will be restricted, because European interests will enter the North American continent through Canada or Mexico, not through the United States. If we are I hate to keep using metaphors here, but the hole in the donut where there's no agreement. I think my last observation will be the philosophy of the two candidates extends beyond trade as it relates to whether or not you do business with others. I think Mr. Trump has, through his campaign generally, articulated an America First philosophy. And while those of us who are American citizens are quite proud to think of ourselves as first in a lot of endeavors, the proposition of America First in a global environment, as opposed to America as a partner around the world, is a distinct and in some parts of the world, concerning proposition, where I think on the Clinton campaign side of the ledger, in some measure because of her experience as Secretary of State, she's more of a campaign of America as a partner around the world, a leading partner, perhaps controlling partner, but still a partner. If you look at Mr. Trump's language about other agreements, if you will, beyond trade agreements like NATO, he has questioned whether NATO still has a vitality and a viability and whether it's still a current global need. Well, in Europe, people are terrified that the United States might withdraw from NATO or somehow change the dynamic of NATO. That is a representative, I think, of Mr. Trump's approach that America should we should have the old Fortress America approach, that it's our way or the highway, not a partnership approach. One could argue either way, whether the partnership and alliance concept is the right way or America First is the right way, but I think that will be, in addition to some of the matters that Ron and Governor Dean discussed, I think it'll be a clear, bright line sort of distinction between the two candidates during the fall campaign. It will include trade, but beyond trade, more about how we approach our dealings with collaboration with our global friends and partners. So, Kathleen, and I guess the one additional point that I would add to that as an example would be, I think Mr. Trump has indicated that he'd walk away from the Paris Climate Accord, which is, again, another global agreement that the United States is part of. Hillary Clinton has clearly endorsed the Paris Climate Accord. There's just a series of those examples where their approach about multilateral engagement and partnership is dramatically different, and the American public will get to choose which approach they prefer.
Well, that's very interesting perspective, and I think that you really did do a great job, and thank you for kind of highlighting the difference between the two candidates on those multilateral engagements, and I think it offers us all good perspective from, you know, your experience as a former ambassador as well. Do you have anything else, Ambassador Giffen, you want to talk about? Or are we good?
No, I think I've probably bored people enough with the ins and outs of trade agreements.
You made me hungry with your sandwich and donut references, but beyond that. Look, we appreciate everyone for joining our call today. We look forward to having you join tomorrow and Thursday from Cleveland as well. You can find an audio recording of this entire briefing on our website at www.dentons.com. And we look forward to speaking to you tomorrow, same time and same place. And we'll be back with more scoop from Cleveland and more good political analysis. So thank you all and have a great day.